It's the morning show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking to Congressman Mike Gallagher this morning. He represents the 8th Congressional District, which encompasses the northeast part of the state, including Door County and Green Bay Appleton. Representative Gallagher was elected in 2016. Welcome to the program, sir.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So we just did an hour on veterans. You are a Marine Corps vet who has seen action in Iraq. I'm assuming Congress must be a walk in the park for you.
Someone asked me, how is it different than your time in the Marine Corps? I said, you know, it's exactly like the Marine Corps, except everyone thinks they're in charge simultaneously.
There's no hierarchy there.
It creates some interesting dilemmas, and it's been a bit of a transition for someone who doesn't come from a political background and never expected to be in this position.
Right. So staying on the veterans issue for a moment, there is a veterans health summit, a mental health summit at UW-Milwaukee at the end of the month. What policies can Congress create to support those who are having issues with this transition, both physically and mentally?
Sure. Well, this is an area, actually, where there's been a lot of positive reform that's happened in the last year and a half, and I know a lot of this has flown under the radar, but Congress has actually done some interesting things. Recently, we passed the VA Mission Act, which the president signed into law last week. It incorporates many of the lessons learned from the CHOICE program. It streamlines duplicative community care programs into one cohesive program. It creates a nonpartisan process for reviewing the VA's assets to ensure vets can get the care they've earned. And it expands the VA's post-9/11 caregiver program to all eras among a host of smaller VA process enhancements. And so that being said, I mean, when I got out of the military, and I think this is true of most people, there is a what's called a TAPS process, Transition Assistance Program. And quite honestly, it's suboptimal. It doesn't set our veterans up for success. And I worry that if you have a vet that's coming off active duty and returning to a place like Northeast Wisconsin, they may not even know what benefits are available to them.
Right.
They may not know that there's a whole community of people that want to help them out. And you worry that if that vet becomes isolated, they can go get down a very dark path. And we've seen just an explosion in problems with mental health in the veterans community. Certainly the problem of suicides, with 22 veterans a day taking their own lives. There's much more that we can do. I've started a pilot program in my district called the Northeast Wisconsin Veterans Battalion, where we're seeing if we can pair returning vets with a mentor in the veteran community just to help them with that transition. So there's a lot we can do both at the federal level, but also just in our own neighborhood without the help of the federal government.
You know, we could spend another hour on this issue, but I'm going to move on. You are a member, I believe, of the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House. I've interviewed Jackie Rosen, Nevada Congresswoman Jackie Rosen, who was also a member of that caucus. Tell us about what that caucus is.
Well, one of the biggest complaints I hear as I travel around Northeast Wisconsin is, now, why can't Congress get anything done? You know, you guys spend all your time yelling at each other online, on cable TV, and you just can't work together to get anything done. And so the mission of the Problem Solvers is to create a space where people from different sides of the aisle can come together and see if they can solve some problems and get some stuff done. You know, I sort of view that as Wisconsin common sense, which is not so common here in Washington, D.C. It's why I've been active in the Problem Solvers. Now, what I think is interesting, though, what you're seeing right now, which gives me some hope, is Problem Solvers is focusing a lot of its energy on process reform, which is to say, how do we get the institution of Congress working again, regardless of how you feel about different policy issues, right? Regardless of your view on healthcare or immigration or take your pick, I think we can all agree that the institution itself is dysfunctional, such that we don't even have robust and honest debates on these issues. And everything is so tightly controlled by, you know, leadership in both parties. That's not the way the institution is supposed to work. Two things have happened to sort of the legislative branch of our government in the last 50 years that are not healthy. One is the systematic surrender of power by Congress to the executive branch. But the other within Congress, and this really dates from the 90s to the present day, and I think fuels the partisanship we see, has been the way in which power within the institution has flowed from the individual members and the committees to leadership. And as such, it's very difficult to get anything done. And so we're trying to fix that. It's why I was able to go, you know, to the White House with three of my Democratic colleagues and have a meeting with President Trump on something like term limits. And we were all speaking the same language. I did an op-ed with a guy named Ro Khanna, who's a very, you know, Bernie Sanders supporting progressive Democrat in Silicon Valley, California. We're probably never going to agree on the role of the federal government in our healthcare system, but we agree on term limits, on ending congressional pension, on banning lobbying for former members. So sorry to go on, but
no.
I really think this is a space where people can work together. And there's been some interesting stuff happening at the state level with, you know, Catherine Gale and Michael Porter had an event in Milwaukee recently. That was a great conversation. So I think there's a lot we can do in this space.
So you were talking about working together. There was a kind of a mini revolt that just did not happen as of last night. A bipartisan effort, a bipartisan coalition to get 218 signatures to put an immigration vote out there. Were you part of that?
I was not part of that, and I really, not because I opposed sort of an effort to have a debate on the issue. It just wasn't, I wasn't, you know, on the committees of jurisdiction.
Did you sign, were you one of the signatories?
I mean,
they came two signs.
I was not one of the signatories. We had but because of that, we did have a summit last week among the entire Republican caucus. And there was what I perceived to be a good faith effort to get the different sides together to agree on a proposal going forward. Now, no one's going to get 100% of what they want. Those of us who feel strongly about border security recognize we're going to have to give and take in some other areas. But I believe based on that discussion I saw last week, and I was not part of the discussion last night, so I don't know what the latest is, there is a path forward. And I do think the White House is committed to getting there too. I don't know where it goes in the Senate. Obviously, they had a series of votes that all failed, but as with any problem, if we do nothing, it will just get worse. And so it may be a difficult vote, but we at the very least need to have the debate.
The economy is important to voters all across the country, but Wisconsin unemployment rate is only 2.8% in April, as of April, which is better than the federal government. Northeast Wisconsin, you are seeing people transition from factories or at least factory workers that didn't need to have skills to factory workers that need skills and other non-factory jobs. What is that looking like in your district?
Well, it's critical that you highlight that trend, which I think is only going to intensify. I mean, listen, I'm one of three millennials in Congress, and it's projected that my generation will hold jobs for, on average, less than 5 years. So that model of, you know, you work in a paper mill for 30, 40 years, it may hold true for some people, but increasingly it's not going to be the norm. And so I think we really need to think about a few things. One, how do we reform and improve our educational system so it allows people who may have their job displaced by automation, which, you know, we're seeing in the paper industry and other industries, or trade, which can be incredibly disruptive, or take your pick, right? How do they then get different skills that they need to thrive in an entirely different industry? And the programs we have for that now are simply not getting the job done. Oftentimes, you know, trade adjustment assistance is the only thing you have open to you, which just isn't that great of an option for that person who's struggling to survive in a different industry. But the second thing I think, and we had a fascinating discussion in Appleton recently that was put on by the Millennial Action Project, and it was me and a Democratic legislator at the state level talking about this very issue. And we all seem to agree that for a while now, we've told a generation of kids that the only option is to go to a four-year college. That's great. I mean, I went to a four-year college. You know, I got a degree in international relations, so far be it for me to criticize that choice. It opened up a lot of opportunities, but there are also other options, right? If you want to go, we have some incredible vocational and technical schools, certainly in my neck of the woods. I mean, there are amazing jobs available. To sort of the first premise of your question, what I hear most frequently from employers in Northeast Wisconsin, and it really doesn't matter what the industry is, you know, listen, you guys love talking about jobs in Washington, D.C. We have jobs available. We have good paying jobs available. We just can't find people to do those jobs. Or I had 20 people come out for a job, 10 had the basic skills, 3 passed the drug test, and only 1 is showing up.
Okay, so where do they get those skills? Does government have a role in helping them develop these skills and get these skills so that they can get jobs?
Well, certainly we have some, you know, very good success stories of public-private partnerships between both state and federal government in a lot of our educational institutions. It's part of what makes the University of Wisconsin system so strong. So that's one area where there can be a productive partnership, although I would rather it be focused on the state level than the federal. But this is also, you know, one of the most remarkable achievements of our free enterprise system in America is the social safety net. And we have to make sure that when people fall on hard times, that we're able to help them, but we don't lock them into a system where they're not able to get back on the economic ladder and climb out of it, which is why I think it is important to take a look at some of these programs and reform them and make sure that we're incentivizing work and entrepreneurship and not the opposite.
We are talking to first-term Congressman Mike Gallagher, who represents the 8th District of Wisconsin. We're going to be back, and we will take your calls, 1-800-642-1234. We've got Mike Gallagher on till the bottom of the hour. It's the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking this half hour with Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin's 8th District, and we are taking your phone calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Congressman Gallagher, let's talk. You were just talking about public-private partnerships. I want to talk a little bit about the Opportunity Fund. What is that? Is this something that we can implement in this state?
The Opportunity Fund. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly what you're
referring. The Opportunity Fund is a public-private
within tax reform, or
yes, within tax reform.
Oh, okay, yeah, absolutely. I apologize. So this is something that I'm really excited about, and you know, put aside kind of what you think about tax reform overall. This is an idea that has been bubbling for a long time, and essentially, it creates a mechanism through which private capital that right now is sitting on the sidelines could be invested in distressed communities in Wisconsin. And it gave governors around the country, including in Wisconsin, the ability to designate a certain amount of our distressed communities as opportunity zones and creates a tax-incentivized way for people to invest their money in businesses in those communities. And I really think it's a promising idea because, you know, let's say you're someone who's been successful in life in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where I live, right? Mm-hmm. And you have some money. Now, you could put that to work in the stock market, but wouldn't you rather, you know, invest in just the neighborhood you know and see sort of the tangible results of not only getting a return on your investment, but also improving lives of your neighbors?
I would if that return on investment was going to be higher than investing in the stock market. I mean, honestly, most people are just thinking about their money growing, right?
Sure. But I think we're blessed in the sense that, well, I believe, and maybe this is a bit naive, that Wisconsin is certainly still a place where people look out for each other, where, you know, we want to be good neighbors, where we want to strengthen our communities. And so my hope, and again, we'll see, the proof will be in the pudding here, is that people will take money that otherwise would just be sitting in an account somewhere and invest it in local businesses and help out their neighbors who are struggling. So this is really has the potential to be a transformative move here and unlock a lot of capital that right now isn't being put to work in service of our fellow men and women who may be falling on hard times right now.
We're probably going to follow up and do a whole show on Opportunity Zones. I want to look at trade for a moment. President Trump just had a very contentious meeting with the G7 leaders and kind of had a tweet storm against Justin Trudeau after Trudeau objected to Trump's proposed tariffs. Wisconsin, our biggest trading partner is Canada, and we actually have almost an $800 million trade surplus with Canada. If we get into a trade war with Canada, what does that do to us?
Well, I think it would hurt our farmers, right, who right now are suffering from one of the most difficult ag economies in a decade. Two things, just let me stipulate at the start. So Twitter, as I've said on multiple occasions, is making all of us stupid. And I think the less time we spend
totally
on
agree.
It, the better.
Yes.
I recognize it's sort of a necessary evil in a way to communicate. But I've as someone who has deleted Twitter from his phone in the last month, it saps your time and attention. I think incentivizes sort of the hot take or an emotional response that may not be statesmanlike. The second thing, I'm not sure I've seen evidence historically of any trade war that turns out well for either party. That being said, President Trump's concerns about trade are legitimate in the sense that Canada does put a 270% tariff on dairy from Wisconsin farmers, and it puts us at a disadvantage, especially at a time when I said they're struggling through the worst farm economy in over a decade. There's certain things they're doing with ultra-processed milk that puts our guys at a disadvantage. So the question then becomes how to most effectively address what is a real problem. And realizing that Canada is one of our closest allies, we need to take an approach that reflects that. And I worry that right now, sort of a Twitter back and forth between Trudeau and Trump is not the most productive way to do that. And I think, there is a perfect forum right now for addressing these issues with Canada, and it's the NAFTA renegotiation talks. And this is why I've joined many of my colleagues in the Wisconsin delegation in pushing for a dairy fix in the NAFTA discussions. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution makes it very clear that the founders intended for Congress to be in the driver's seat on trade policy such as tariffs, and I think it's time for Congress to step up. And so I think there's room for a productive conversation among friends, particularly when it comes to NAFTA. And we just, you know, what I hear from farmers is, you know, we don't want a handout, we don't want any special treatment, we just want to compete on a level playing field, and we want to open market so Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers can sell to the 96% of the world's customers that don't live in the continental United States.
And are you telling the White House this, that we don't need a trade war here?
We certainly are. Now, the president, and I think one advisor in particular, Peter Navarro, feel very strongly that this is a good way to get concessions from some of our allies. Now, certainly, you know, they can point to South Korea in response to tariffs, did negotiate with the White House and get an agreement that was beneficial to us, and perhaps as this goes forward, we'll see similar agreements take shape. But I do worry because ultimately tariffs are a tax on our own citizens. That's all they are. And if the EU is going to retaliate on Wisconsin farmers in response to steel and aluminum tariffs, I'm just not sure how that's good for anybody that I represent in Northeast Wisconsin.
We have been talking to District 8 Representative Mike Gallagher. Congressman Gallagher, thank you for being on the show with us this morning.
This was a real pleasure. I appreciate it and look forward to coming back.
Yeah, me too. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and you're listening to The Morning Show.